Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Dilma's Last Stand, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brazil's suspended president Dilma Rousseff is facing impeachment this week. And the thing is, her replacement is accused of breaking the law, too.
Does the Brazilian Congress, do the Brazilian people have the stomach for another impeachment? Nobody that I've spoken to says that they have. It's very unlikely to happen.
Plus, Uzbekistan's president rules with an iron fist, but now he's had a stroke. And what happens next is anyone's guess.
This is not even North Korea, where we at least see the pictures. We're talking about a very, very isolated government that's in charge of, you know, 30 million people, in charge of Central Asia's biggest country.
Those stories, plus a secretive tribunal known as the ISDS, today here on The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. We're going to begin today with a story that's been going on for months now, but this week is finally coming to a close. Brazil's suspended president, Dilma Rousseff, is about to lose her job. Rousseff testified at her own impeachment trial this morning, and the final impeachment vote comes later this week. A reminder, Rousseff is accused of concealing Brazil's budget problems, which she denies. Will Carlos is our correspondent in Brazil. What did Rousseff say in her speech today, Will?
Well, it was a really fiery, really impassioned speech from someone who's not really known for making strong speeches. At the same time, it was kind of more of the same. It was basically she denounces the whole process against her as being a coup. She reflected back on her time as a militant and sort of made kind of a plea to save Brazilian democracy. That was, I guess, the sort of overarching theme. It was like, look, this isn't just about me. This is about the Brazilian democratic process and not undermining the fact that I was voted in by 54 million people.
Is that hyperbole, or do you think Brazilian democracy is at stake?
Gosh, that is such a tough question to answer. I mean, especially without sort of getting into personal opinion. But I mean, look, she certainly has a point. I mean, she was voted in, but at the same time, there are these laws on the books that say, look, you're not allowed to do some of the things that she appears to have done. So it's really, you can make a very strong argument either way. The lawyers have been making those strong arguments. I think the takeaway from this, though, Marco, is that this isn't really about what she legally did or didn't do. This seems to be much more a sort of a political deal. This is a judgment on her presidency. It's a judgment on the state of economy. And in that sense, she does have a point that, look, I mean, every time the economy goes down the tubes or something really bad happens, you sort of manufacture a way to get rid of the president. It doesn't work like that. You're supposed to see these things out and have elections and all the rest of it.
So I saw that Dilma Rousseff had about 200 supporters at this hearing, some shouting, "Come back, Dilma." Were they there on their own volition, or were they brought in? I mean, how widespread is her support at this point?
Well, her support is definitely still widespread. And of course, she does have her party. She has her allies still in Congress. It should be stated that they're far fewer than they were just a couple of years ago. But, you know, she also brought in some heavy hitters. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Lula as he's known, was there. Lula is, by the way, widely expected to run in 2018. So part of the undercurrent of this speech was not just Dilma trying to keep her mandate. It's more that it was seen as sort of paving the way for a run by Lula and trying to sort of leave with her head held high and her party's head, some of her party's reputation intact.
So after Dilma Rousseff took the stand today, if we look at this as like the stock market, where are the tickers right now in terms of likelihood that Rousseff will be voted out?
Very, very high that she's going to be voted out. There have been several votes at the Senate already, and they've exceeded the 54 senators needed to remove her by quite a margin. So nobody that I've spoken to thinks that she's going to survive past Wednesday.
The current acting president of Brazil, Michel Temer, you've suggested in the past, Will, that if Rousseff is out, he might also face impeachment hearings. Is that true?
Well, one of the really bizarre and interesting things about this is if you look at the technicalities of what Dilma's accused of doing, she's accused of basically signing off on these sort of de facto loans from public banks to government coffers. Now, the interesting thing is that Michel Temer did exactly the same thing. When Dilma was out of the country, he was responsible for doing this stuff. Now, he says in his defense, I may have sort of been involved in the technicalities of doing this, but I didn't make the fiscal policy that led to making these loans, which is what Dilma's getting in trouble for. So in very technical terms, he could very well be, you know, impeached for the same thing. The thing is, does the Brazilian Congress, do the Brazilian people have the stomach for another impeachment? Nobody that I've spoken to says that they have. We've got 2 years left. I think going through another sort of 6 month long impeachment process is very unlikely to happen. I'd say the odds of him keeping that mandate and staying until 2018 are pretty strong.
Will Carlos, our man in Brazil. Thanks very much, Will.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
In Uzbekistan, they've had only one president ever. It's Islam Karimov. He was elected 25 years ago, right after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and he's kept the former Soviet state under iron-tight control ever since. But his family says he's in intensive care after a brain hemorrhage, and there is no apparent successor. There was, at one point, his daughter Gulnara, but he had her put under house arrest. Natalia Antalava is a journalist and has reported on the Karimov family over the years. She's on the line with us from the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. So one of the world's most authoritarian leaders has been hospitalized. What do we know precisely about the situation, Natalia?
The fact that we know that he is in a hospital is in itself very, very telling. The big debate right now is whether he's alive at all or not. He might not be anymore, because in the previous years there have been numerous rumors about all sorts of conditions that he's had, and the Uzbek government has never made an official statement about any sort of medical emergency that he's gone through. So the very fact that we know that he's for sure in the hospital, that the government has made the statement, he's one of his daughters has also said on her Instagram feed that he's in a hospital, that in itself is very telling and probably means that things are very, very serious and there is very little doubt in anyone's mind that he's not going to be coming back to the office.
So I know there's not a lot of dissent, but we do know that there's also not a lot of love for Karimov in Uzbekistan. What are people expecting in terms of succession if he dies or if he's already dead? How crazy could it get?
We're talking about, I mean, this is not even North Korea where we at least see the pictures. We're talking about a very, very isolated government that's in charge of, you know, 30 million people, in charge of Central Asia's biggest country. And in terms of when someone is talking about succession plan, it's almost impossible to predict. There are some educated guesses. Personally, from everything that I know, and again, it's very little, I think there is a succession plan in place. I think they will sort it out. And I think the people of Uzbekistan, despite all the hardships and awful years that they've gone through with Islam Karimov, they will see very, very little change. This is a president who is very old. I think they have been preparing for it for a while. If I were to guess, I would guess that the transition will be smooth, or at least as smooth as they can make it. I think the effect on the people will be minimal.
Uzbekistan's seen a rise in extremism, too, it should be noted. A number of Uzbek radicals have joined ISIS, and the state of Uzbekistan has been battling them along with political dissenters at large. Is there a feeling that Islamists, though, might take power if Karimov dies?
I think it is so unlikely that anyone outside the Uzbek establishment will take power when Karimov dies. Overall, in Uzbekistan, the dissent has been crushed to such an extent that it is absolutely impossible to imagine anyone taking charge of any sort of uprising. One of the things that Islam Karimov will be remembered for is boiling people alive.
That's been documented? There is proof of that?
That has been documented. There is proof that men have been boiled alive to death in Islam Karimov's jails. And so in that environment, to imagine any sort of an uprising, be it Islamic or any other, it's almost impossible.
Natalia, let me ask you about Karimov's daughters, because one of them, Gulnara, was seen as troublesome, and her own father had her put under house arrest. You actually managed to engage her in a conversation on Twitter some time ago. And the other daughter, she apparently alerted the world to her father's illness. You think the Karimov name will live on if he in fact dies?
It does look like the second daughter is still in favor. She's still very much part of the family, and she is speaking on behalf of her father. But unlike her older sister, she has never openly expressed any desire to be in charge. So it looks to me, and again, I'm slightly speculating, but it does look like she's done the deal with the people who will be running the country from now on. And, you know, some people are wondering whether Gulnara, the eldest, is going to try to stage a comeback. From everything that I know, it looks very, very unlikely. I think she was in a very weak position before she was pushed out.
Our friend and reporter Natalia Antalava with the latest on Islam Karimov of Uzbekistan. Thanks very much, Natalia.
Sure, thank you.
We have a story now about a man named Harry Fujiwara. He died yesterday at the age of 82. Fujiwara was a professional wrestler in the WWE, but fans know him better this way.
From Osaka, Japan, it is Mr. Fuji!
Although Mr. Fuji was billed as being from Japan, that wasn't quite right. Greg Oliver has written several books about professional wrestling, and he filled me in on the man outside the ring.
Harry Fujiwara was, like a lot of the Japanese heels or bad guys, he was actually of Hawaiian descent. There were a lot of wrestlers in Hawaii. It was a popular territory, and there was a gym where they all worked out, and Harry worked out there, and he was not a huge guy, but he was pretty well built, you know, about 235 pounds on his 5'10" frame, and you know, they convinced him to try wrestling, and he definitely found something he was really good at.
What year was that? When did he start his whole career?
It was about 1962. Like a lot of these guys, I mean, they may start at that point, but their career doesn't really take off until they start wrestling full time. And it's really around 1966 that he makes his first trip to North America, mainland, and he starts in Portland and ends up in San Francisco, and then eventually makes it out to New York and the WWF, where he becomes a tag team champion. And really, that's where his legacy was cemented.
What was Mr. Fuji like offstage?
It's sort of two sides. Certainly with people like me that he dealt with, he was always nice and professional. And he knew to be like that with fans and professional people. But with his colleagues, the guy was a notorious river. Like wrestlers, like hockey players or baseball players, they have a ton of time on the road for hijinks. But Mr. Fuji was notorious for being almost mean-spirited with his ribs.
What would he do?
You'd find your clothes, you know, maybe glued together or cut up, or the wonder of this wrestling business. Unlike baseball, where everything's documented to a T, that you know exactly what happened in the day. Pro wrestling still got that carnival side to it, where there's not a ton of records, and it's great fun for writers and historians like me to try and figure out what's the truth and what isn't.
So, Greg, folklore aside, how is the wrestling world reacting to the death of Mr. Fuji?
Well, it'll be interesting. I'm sure they'll do some sort of tribute on Monday Night Raw on the WWE's flagship program tonight, just because he's in the WWE Hall of Fame. A lot of people knock the WWE Hall of Fame because it's a company. They're deciding who's in there. It's on a whim. I mean, the Vince McMahon's limo driver is in their Hall of Fame, James Dudley. So it's a bit of a crock that way. But for the guys who were in there, including Mr. Fuji, who was inducted in 2007, it meant a heck of a lot to be in there, and they enjoy that moment in the sun.
What will you remember him for, Greg Oliver?
Well, he was always cool to me. The times I interviewed him on the phone, he wasn't particularly forthcoming. But for me, as a child who grew up watching that Hulk Hogan Rock and Wrestling, he was always a manager at ringside, and he was he'd make you laugh, and he'd make you, you know, really infuriated at how he could help his wrestlers win the matches. But in the end, I think I loved hearing the stories about who he was, and as a river, as a joker, and as a family man. Those give you a much better picture of who the guy was in the end. And the world certainly lost a great character yesterday.
Sports writer Greg Oliver telling me about the late Mr. Fuji, fantastic wrestler. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, returning from life on Mars, or maybe just a hole in Hawaii. That's on the world. New York City is in the midst of an identity crisis, one that's been going on for quite a while. It's the old issue of gentrification. Neighborhoods traditionally thought of as solidly immigrant working class are changing, and rents are sky high. Today, Ashley Cleek takes us to one neighborhood, Sunset Park in Brooklyn, where longtime residents are wondering if they can afford to stay.
Inside a courtyard sandwiched between two old factories, men and women twist through the steps of salsa. On the sidelines, couples circle their hips and shoulders in anticipation of the next song. They sip beers and eat Puerto Rican comfort food. It feels like a throwback, a good old neighborhood barbecue. But it's actually something of a community relations event put on by a private company that's recently moved into the neighborhood. Outside the gates, a dozen or so people are protesting. They wave giant black flags that read, "No displacement." They're scared this event and the development behind it will squeeze them out of their neighborhood.
Scared isn't even the word. Like, it's just, it's kind of like, what do I do?
Antoinette Martinez is 29. She's lived in this neighborhood all her life, but she can't afford her own apartment here. And she's worried what will happen if and when her parents' rent goes up. Martinez's grandparents moved to New York City from Puerto Rico. They bought their first house here, and the whole family lived together when she was growing up. Martina says her father loves salsa music. So every Sunday when she was a kid, he would put two speakers in the windows.
He would blast it. If you went, like, across the street, like, you would hear the music blasting. So, like, it was always a part of me. Like, it was just something, like, my parents, they would always dance to.
Then, 3 years ago, Jamestown Properties bought up 16 massive buildings and started to turn the area into Industry City, a place that would be filled with small-scale manufacturing, tech, and media jobs. And when Industry City threw this salsa party recently, it hit a nerve with Martinez and others in the community. Another protester, June Allende, says the whole event felt like a ploy.
They take pictures while they do these events and say, hey, look, we're for the community.
We have people of color at our events.
We have people of color at our events.
The development company says this simply isn't true. Crystal Rivera is the director of community engagement at Industry City. She's also Puerto Rican. And she's kind of exasperated by these allegations. She says the salsa parties are not a ploy to trick the community. They are a response to what the community asked for.
And I think that that's our job, really, as a property that's in a place that has a diverse community, right, is to be responsive to what people would like to see happening here.
This is where my family, like, settled. In Sunset Park.
After work one day, I meet up with Antoinette Martinez again, and we walk through the park that gives the neighborhood its name. It's a quarter Asian and almost 50% Latino. The majority are originally from Puerto Rico. And it has a perfect view of the Statue of Liberty.
So if we keep walking up, like, you'll see a beautiful view of the waterfront, and then that's basically what all of these companies and, like, Industry City are really going after.
The neighborhood's waterfront used to be a manufacturing center, shipping and lots of garment factories. And most of the neighborhood used to work here. But you know the story. American manufacturing jobs moved overseas and factory buildings were abandoned. Now, Industry City is trying to bring life and work back to the waterfront. But the development is also pushing up real estate prices at a time when real estate values in New York are exploding anyway. Apartments in Sunset Park are twice as expensive as they were 5 years ago, which means that adults like Martinez still live with their parents, and some families sleep two or three people to a room. Columbia University sociologist Van Tran says Sunset Park is a snapshot of a countrywide feeling of financial unease and dislocation.
I think what you're seeing in Sunset Park is that our traditional idea of the American dream, of upward social mobility, of hard work leading to success, of owning a home that you could afford, is increasingly unattainable to the new generations of immigrants who have arrived, but also to the children of the older generation of Puerto Ricans who have lived there for the last 35 years.
Tran stresses there are good things that come from gentrification, decreased crime, and better city services. But, he says, communities like Sunset Park will need help to stay in their homes. Tran says cities have to build more affordable housing. And lawmakers should think about creating rent control policies for local businesses so that families and mom-and-pop stores aren't priced out.
So this Chinese restaurant is closed. I wouldn't be surprised if they
are building up something else here.
Martinez has finally decided she'll have to leave Sunset Park if she wants a place of her own. So she's looking about an hour and a half away in the Bronx. As for her parents, Martinez says they've rented in Sunset Park for more than a decade. So if the rent goes up or their building gets sold, they're thinking of moving back with family in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, they're thinking about moving there because then if they live out there, they don't have to worry about paying rent or anything because they own the house.
Martinez says the pace of the neighborhood's transformation is sometimes staggering.
This looks nothing. Oh my God, this is not.
Some blocks don't look at all like her home.
Yeah, it looks so different.
But from the highest point in the park, the view hasn't changed. The Statue of Liberty and the tip of Manhattan. For the world, I'm Ashley Gleek.
As we go up, like it's super breathtaking. And then when we stand over here, you'll see everything.
We're going to hear now what happened when six NASA scientists returned to Earth.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Come on, back to Earth.
For the past year, six men and women have lived on Mars. Yeah, let me explain. This was actually a virtual Mars mission. It took place in a small dome structure in the dormant Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. 360-plus days ago, the scientists basically locked themselves in and pretended they were on Mars.
It's very isolated.
Andre Stewart was the mission's chief engineering officer.
In the last year, I haven't been farther than 2 kilometers away from a single point. So it's just moving around today. It's very freeing, but it's a very interesting place. It's separated from sort of a lot of the bad news you hear back on planet Earth. So all of a sudden, you know, you're isolated and it gives you a way to focus on the work you're doing, focus on doing something good for humanity.
Getting that focus meant some hardship. There was no running water, all the food was freeze-dried, and when they went outside the volcano to explore the Martian terrain, they had to wear 70-pound spacesuits. And inside, things got kind of cramped. Carmel Johnston was the mission commander.
It's definitely been a challenge to live in a dome without any privacy. You get to hear everything that happens everywhere around you, and even if you try to be quiet, everyone can still hear what you're doing. And so it's been a really interesting experience. It's kind of like having roommates that just are always there and you can never escape them. So I'm sure some people can imagine what that's like. And if you can't, then just imagine never being able to get away from anybody.
NASA might want to leave that part out of the Mars brochure. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Spanish-speaking world mourns the loss of Mexican singer Juan Gabriel.
He was huge. When I mean huge, I mean really, really big. He was just a very gifted singer that wrote songs that were accessible to everybody.
The king of Latin pop, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The war in Syria is getting even more complicated, especially for the U.S. Over the past couple of days, Turkey has been bombing sites in Syria, but it's not exactly targeting ISIS. Turkey is going after Kurdish military sites and other targets. Remember that Turkey is a U.S. ally in the fight against ISIS. But then again, so are the Kurds. So basically, two of the U.S. allies in Syria are fighting each other. We called up the world's Richard Hall in Beirut for a breakdown on Turkey's actions.
So ostensibly, the reason they said they were entering is to go after the Islamic State and stop rocket attacks coming from Syria. There were a couple of rocket attacks that hit Turkish towns. A second reason they said for going in was to prevent the Kurdish forces in Syria from linking up their two territories and controlling most of the border from Iraq to the Mediterranean. They were trying to stop the Kurds from controlling that stretch of border there.
So it's kind of an international fight against ISIS, but also some domestic issues for Turkey targeting the Kurds. Is it clear what's at the top of Turkey's agenda, ISIS or responding to Kurdish fighters?
Well, judging by where the fighting's happening over the past few days, it would seem to be that the Kurds were on the receiving end of most of it. And to understand this, we have to actually go back to Turkey and look at what's going on there in the southeast, in the Kurdish-majority areas. There's quite a vicious urban war going on between a Kurdish militant group called the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Turkish army. You've seen Kurdish cities leveled by this fighting. And just the other day, there was a bomb attack by the Kurdish Workers' Party against a police station. So Turkey is fighting this kind of vicious urban war in Turkey, with this Kurdish group. And this Kurdish group is linked to this Syrian Kurdish group that the US is backing in the fight against ISIS. So Turkey basically sees ISIS and the Syrian Kurds as basically the same. They're both threats to Turkey, while the US separates the two and supports the Syrian Kurds. So it's kind of a kind of a messy triangle of relations there between the three.
So just as an aside, Rich, we're talking about Syria, but Turkey apparently is also targeting villages in northern Iraq. Is it generally the same situation as Syria, both ISIS and Kurdish targets?
Yeah, so northern Iraq is where the Kurdistan Workers' Party has its bases. They're kind of on the border there between Iraq and Turkey. They live in the Kandil Mountains there. It's kind of where their bases are. And they cross the border there from the mountains into Turkey and carry out attacks against the Turkish army and Turkish police force.
So how is the U.S. responding to all this? Because they would obviously like to see Turkey stick to that fight against ISIS, right?
Yeah, I think they were kind of caught off guard by the direction this offensive went in. I was engaged in a kind of back-and-forth email exchange with a spokesman from U.S. Central Command last night, and they actually didn't have a response for me when I first asked, like, is the U.S. still supporting this offensive now that it's targeting your allies? Eventually, they came up with a response. They said, they're still supporting Turkey in fighting ISIS, but these attacks against the Kurdish allied forces are not being coordinated with the U.S. They said, I quote, we do not support them and they are not coordinated with U.S. forces. So they're kind of caught in a very tricky situation at the moment.
So after Joe Biden's meeting, very friendly meeting, it seemed, with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, what's to be done now if this fight against the Kurds, a U.S. ally, continues?
Well, the key demand of Turkey is for Kurdish forces and their affiliated militias to withdraw east of the Euphrates River. That's been a demand they've been making for a long time now. So if the U.S. can convince Kurdish forces and Kurdish affiliated forces to withdraw east of the Euphrates, we might see a kind of uneasy status quo. At the moment, there's no real sign that the Kurds are going to do that. They've been fighting for these towns in this area. They've lost lives taking these towns back from the Islamic State. And now they're being told by one of their fiercest enemies to leave the town now and let our friends go in. So there's kind of this difficult situation. Whether the U.S. can convince the Kurdish forces to do that, it's unclear at the moment.
The world's own Richard Hall in Beirut. Thanks for explaining this to us, Rich.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
So I learned something today about one of the ways that international corporations can seek protection from governments that challenge them over issues like pollution or licensing or taxes. These corporations can turn to a little-known but extremely powerful international tribunal. It's called the Investor State Dispute Settlement Program, or ISDS, and it's been the subject of an 18-month-long investigation by BuzzFeed, led by reporter Chris Hamby. Chris joins me now from Washington. I know some people's eyes glaze over hearing about tribunals and corporations and dispute settlement. In a nutshell, why should people care about the ISDS, Chris?
ISDS is enshrined in treaties that a vast number of nations around the world are part of, and it is essentially a private justice system that is designed to protect property rights of individuals and corporations. And though it operates largely in secret, is not really subject to appeal and is really not accountable to the public in any meaningful way, it has the power to issue decisions that have substantial implications for people all over the world, really.
So a private justice system that trumps international and national law?
So it's important to realize what they can and cannot do in these tribunals, and they cannot order a state to overturn its laws. But what it can do is impose penalties that are so devastating. We're talking hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars here. And this is especially bad for less developed countries that can scarcely afford it and may not be able to mount a particularly good defense before one of these tribunals, which is a very sort of arcane area of the law. And so what we've seen is that actually when faced with a case or a threat of a case is that they will change their laws voluntarily or provide other concessions to avoid these staggering penalties.
So you give a lot of examples in your lengthy report of how companies appear to have used the ISDS basically to get away with bad behavior. But there's one especially shocking example of this story of a battery maker in El Salvador. Tell us about that.
Right. So this was a community, Sitio del Niño, in El Salvador. It's a little bit outside of the capital there of San Salvador, and it's a small community. It's fairly impoverished, largely a farming community. This factory that recycles lead-acid batteries, which is an incredibly toxic process, moved in there, and what the environmental regulators and ultimately a court determined was that they had not implemented the proper controls to prevent the lead from getting out of their factory, and that they should have known this was happening all along. And they ended up finally, after the citizens complained for years, ended up filing a criminal case. And what happened was, behind closed doors, no one has seen this before, is that lawyers for the factory sent a threat letter to the Salvadoran government saying that if basically you have violated our rights under the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and we were going to claim $70 million. And what ultimately happened, it's kind of a long and complicated and twisted story, but what ultimately happened is that the factory is not on the hook for a cleanup and medical care that the government says will cost $4 billion. And the owners of the factory are living in the United States and have not been extradited. And you have in this community, it is, remains an, quote, environmental emergency as declared by the government for 6 years now. And you have children with levels of lead in their blood that are 3, 5, 6, 7 times the safe limit. So very sick. When I was there, there had been a child who had actually just suddenly died 6 days earlier. Wow. It's a very dire situation.
You write in your story that some people, even in the ISDS program, like to joke about how powerful they are. What do they say?
Well, you go to some of these events and talk with some of these people, and you know, they sort of jokingly, half jokingly, really, sometimes refer to themselves as the club or the mafia, International Arbitration Mafia. I've heard a few times in interviews and at events that I've attended. It is a pretty tight circle. There's no doubt that a fairly small number of prominent lawyers at major firms in the United States and Western Europe are the dominant players in this system.
So bottom line here, Chris, are you alleging that this tribunal is corrupt or has just gotten too powerful?
Well, I think I'm just trying to lay out all the facts of what has happened, how this system has developed over the years, and let people draw their own conclusions from the fact that it basically by design lacks many of the safeguards that a developed court system would have and does have. And I think it's just something that people need to be aware of because it does have influence on issues of public policy.
Chris Hamby, who has led the BuzzFeed investigation into the Investor State Dispute Settlement Program, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
You won't need DEET for these next two stories, and they are about mosquito-borne diseases. In a few minutes, good news about combating a potential outbreak of yellow fever in Congo. But first to Singapore, the latest place in the world where the Zika virus has shown up. Over the weekend, health officials in Singapore confirmed their first locally transmitted cases of Zika. Singapore is a densely populated tropical island that gets lots of rain, perfect for mosquitoes that can transmit the virus. Journalist Sharanya Pillay is in Singapore. How many cases have now been reported, Sharanya?
So we have had 56 cases right now that have been reported, and we might be expecting more cases as well.
56 cases, that's a lot. Did this all happen at once, or has this been steadily growing over the past few weeks?
The jump was quite abrupt. So on Saturday, we had the first locally transmitted case of Zika that was reported. But just over the next day, the number had risen to 41. And today, 15 new cases were reported.
I know Singapore's got a reputation for being a very tightly managed country with a kind of top-down approach. What kind of reaction has there been to the sudden onslaught of Zika cases?
Yeah, I think the reaction has been one of deep concern because many Singaporeans are aware of how Zika can be very threatening to pregnant women. there's also been quite a bit of shock because the situation has escalated this quickly. But at the same time, I think Singaporeans are quite used to the idea of us being very vulnerable, because in 2003, we also went through the SARS crisis. And I think there are fears that this Zika outbreak might put us in a similar situation as what we went through in 2003.
And do people in Singapore use mosquito nets or insect repellent?
Mosquito repellent is definitely very much in use. As you mentioned earlier, there are a lot of mosquitoes around because of the hot and wet climate. People are stepping up their use of insect repellent, especially for those who are vulnerable, like young children. Mm. And the Ministry of Health itself is encouraging people to do more to actually prevent puddles of stagnant water from forming in their own homes so that mosquitoes don't breed in our own houses.
Yeah, and with so many cases suddenly reported, are health officials in Singapore really putting a very urgent push?
The response has been very quick. Health officials are continuing to screen for more cases. They have also alerted doctors to look out for symptoms of Zika in patients. And mainly the main strategy for the health authorities right now is to focus on controlling the population of Aedes mosquitoes. And so they have stepped up efforts of misting that will kill adult mosquitoes. And they have also focused their efforts on our sewage system. So they are flushing out their drains more frequently to prevent stagnant water from forming. Singapore already has very tough regulations against mosquito breeding. So anyone who is found to have conditions in their homes that is causing a lot of mosquitoes to breed, they are actually subject to fines. And the authorities, they have been stepping up their inspections of houses, especially in the cluster where all these Zika cases have emerged.
Sort of taking even a tough approach. How often do you see like stagnant water or water puddles in your own neighborhood in Singapore?
I think stagnant water puddles are not a common sight in Singapore, but they tend to be more frequently seen around construction areas. And in fact, if you look at the current situation now, about 36 of the people who were infected, they are actually foreign workers who are working at a construction site. The fact that so many of them are actually construction workers actually highlights the need for there to be more inspection perhaps at these areas for stagnant puddles of water.
Yeah, that also indicates there's a lot of construction in Singapore these days.
Oh, yes, yes. Singapore is a nation that is perpetually under construction and we are always working on new projects.
Reporter Sharanya Pillay in Singapore, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Here's a challenge for you. How to vaccinate nearly 7 million people in less than 2 weeks. Ask the Congolese. There have been growing fears that an outbreak of yellow fever might spread through the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, one of the largest cities in Africa. So health officials and NGOs began a race to get as much of the population as possible vaccinated. And they managed to reach 91% of the target population. Tommy Trenchard is a photojournalist who accompanied Save the Children's staff as they took part in the drive. Tommy joins us from Kampala in neighboring Uganda. Why was this vaccination drive so urgent, Tommy?
Well, the disease crossed over from Angola earlier this year, and it's already killed over 400 people. Kinshasa is a, as you say, an enormous city. Nobody quite knows exactly how many people live there. Some estimates put it as high as 17 million. And it is the perfect breeding ground for the mosquitoes that spread the virus. It's full of puddles, the drainage system is very poor. And next month, the rainy season begins, which will increase the amount of mosquitoes spreading this virus.
So you have one photograph of an all-wheel drive vehicle going up this dirt road. It's laden with vaccines. How tough was it to reach 7 million people in basically 2 weeks?
I think it was quite an achievement. It was actually just 10 days they accomplished those figures in.
Wow.
Kinshasa's infrastructure is very poor, and the vaccine needs to be kept at a certain temperature between 2 and 8 degrees in order to retain its efficiency. And each morning they get driven out across Kinshasa to hundreds and hundreds of different vaccination points.
You've also got a photo, Tommy, of a grandmother with her granddaughter getting vaccinated. Tell me about them. How typical were they of people who were part of this campaign?
I'd say they were very typical of people turning up to get vaccinated. The little girl, whose name is Shalidia, is pictured sitting on a bench next to her grandmother. Shalidia, like most of the children her age, doesn't quite understand everything that's going on. They're always terrified when they turn up, and then suddenly they realize the injection is all over. before they even knew it.
Right.
And her mother is smiling away. There's a kind of sense of contentment, which I saw in vaccination centers across Kinshasa.
I mean, this is a successful bit of good news. But what about the future? I mean, the vast majority of yellow fever infections in the world happen in Africa, and vaccination is the main strategy for eradication. Do experts have an outside estimate when yellow fever could be eradicated from the continent?
I think it's very hard to tell at this stage. One problem is that the world is running very low on yellow fever vaccines, which means that people were given what's known as a fractionalized dose. In this case, that's 20% of the regular dose, and it protects people only for a year. So in a year's time, this will have to happen again once the world has produced more of the vaccine, and people will then get a top-up that will keep them safe for the next decade at least. And it may be possible that future vaccination campaigns will be required.
Photographer Tommy Trenchard worked with Save the Children to bring these really encouraging images of the vaccination campaign in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, to us. Thanks very much, Tommy.
Thank you.
Finally today, we want to pay tribute to the Mexican singer Juan Gabriel.
Por eso aún estoy en el lugar de siempre.
It's remarkable to see his impact. Tributes from fans around the globe have been pouring in since Juan Gabriel died over the weekend from a heart attack at the age of 66. One fan, a big fan, is our friend, reporter Beto Arcos. So, Beto, you call Juan Gabriel the king of Latin pop music. I know your whole family are huge fans, especially your older brother and sister. You remember listening to Juan Gabriel as a kid with your siblings?
Vividly. I was, you know, 9-10 years old in my home in Jalapa, Mexico, and he was the soundtrack of my family for years and years. I mean, Juan Gabriel was huge, but not just in my family. I mean, you could hear him around the block on radio stations, and everybody would buy the record. He was huge. When I mean huge, I mean really, really big.
I mean, you're right. Our Latino colleagues in the newsroom were also paying homage to him this weekend, an artist who, after all, had a career that spanned several generations, so not too surprising. What made him, though, this enduring king of Latin pop?
The thing about Juan Gabriel that no one can take away from him is that he managed to write songs that were simple and touched millions because, you see, the thing about his appeal is that he was able to reach everyone, and especially working class people, meaning the majority of not just Mexicans, but everyone in the Spanish-speaking world.
Right. Well, as you wrote this weekend, his debut was with a song called No Tengo Dinero, I Have No Money. So a lot of people apparently related to that.
Oh, yeah. And I could relate to that. And my brother could relate to that. I mean, we were, you know, working class family in a small town in Mexico, and all of our friends were like us. So we could easily relate to that. A young singer, and he looked like us, singing songs that we identified with immediately.
Now, Juan Gabriel never married, but he had four children. A lot of people assumed he was gay. He never confirmed nor denied it. But whatever he was sexually, it seems he broke down barriers as well as stereotypes of what a typical Mexican macho singer could be, yeah?
He was definitely the first one that would come out on national television, and you could tell he was different. He was, I mean, everybody assumed that he was gay. In fact, in an interview on Univision in 2002, he was asked by one of these TV journalists, so, you know, are you gay? And he says, you know, they say you should not question that which you can see, my son.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it's like, why are you asking this silly question? Can't you see who I am?
Interesting. So I know his last concert was just Friday night in Los Angeles, where you are, and he closed the show with a Spanish version of the tune Have You Ever Seen the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival, of course, a track he sings also on a new CD, Quiero Creedence, which is a Spanish tribute album to Creedence. It really feels today like that song takes on this decidedly different meaning.
Absolutely. And not only that, among the dozens of artists and singers, John Fogerty, the man who wrote that song, actually was also paying tribute online about the stature of this major singer from the Spanish-speaking world, Juan Gabriel.
Beto Arcos hosts the weekly podcast, The Cosmic Barrio. Thanks for your memories of Juan Gabriel, Beto. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
check out some classic performances by Juan Gabriel throughout the years, including the video to this track. It's all at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
RI, Public Radio International.